afterwards, it's always completely different to that anyway. So
Right.
so we'll see. Kerry Davis, how are you today?
Great. Yep, very good. It's always busy, so that's kind of I'm usually in one state or another of urgency. So that's basically sort of how that seems to be the experience of editing a magazine, really. So at the moment, I'm kind of on like maybe an 8 out of 10, get a, you know, probably a, no, probably a more, yeah, more of a 9. What am I talking about? It's more of a 9. I'm in a deadline week at the moment, so that's kind of why my state of mind is reflective of that. But other than that, all good. I've just had a nice run, so that's good.
I guess you live a life that revolves around deadlines, don't you? That's
yeah.
It, really, isn't it? Deadline.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, you have 13 of them a year for the print magazine alone, but you also have other deadlines within that, you know, for particular projects and that sort of thing. You've got to keep the churn of the website going. You've got to keep social media updated. You sort of, and I do other bits and pieces as well. So I write as well as edit the magazine. I obviously do freelance writing for people as well. So I kind of get those into the mix as well. And considering that I'm like, anybody who knows me will tell you that punctuality isn't always my speciality. So the fact that I've constructed a professional life which is like so based around deadlines is probably the worst idea I could have ever come up with, really. So yeah, just don't be like me.
That's hilarious, isn't it? You do the website and the social media as well.
Yeah, it's basically the whole, you know, I'm sort of responsible for the whole brand, really. So everything that, I mean, obviously I don't do it all personally. There are people that are free, you know, contributors and freelancers who help with things as well. But it's not just editing the magazine. It's overseeing and developing the whole brand. So you do the print product, which is part of it, but you've also got the web presence, social media. So I've just got a random bit of hair there that's annoying me. And everything, yeah, everything that kind of goes with it. There's obviously the commercial side of things as well, which I have quite a lot of involvement in, more so than you would have done as an editor in the past. It's very like multifaceted, really. You've got the print magazine, one thing, but you've also got the web, social media, commercial side of things, and then it's also kind of, I actually do it on a freelance basis. So you've got the job of running your own business essentially on top of that as well. So I'm responsible for all the contributor payments and GDPR compliance and all that sort of stuff as well. So there's like there's a job on top of the job in terms of just running all that sort of things as well. But it's because it's TGO, really, that's sort of why I do it.
You've seen the change, haven't you, through your career? When you started out, it would have been a magazine.
Yeah.
And yeah, we whole multimedia kebang, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. I mean, and that's the last, I was a deputy editor on TGO. It was my first probably proper job in 2010. And then maybe 2009, one of those. And I did that for about 3 years. And then there was a change underway in the magazine publishing world. And newspapers in general, like print journalism, was in a state of extreme flux and lots of people losing their jobs. And so I probably came in at the very like tail end of, I suppose, what you would look at as like the old world of print media, really. And I started out doing the job where I went into an office, where I wore office clothes and worked with other people in a physical office in the middle of Glasgow. And I was employed, there was, you know, an office, a huge building that had that had newspapers in it as well and so on. And then over the 2 years I was there, that building was just hollowed out with redundancies. And then it's since then, that was part, you know, I moved to London for a bit to do the job as well. But then I think, you know, that's part of the reason why I, when the job at the BMC came up, I kind of leapt at it a bit, because it was a lot more job security than I was potentially getting in the magazine world. But since then, I think there's sort of been a massive and quite like traumatic process of adjustment. And now, you know, I've sort of come back into the TGO, and it is a very different entity, and the experience of working for it is very, the experience of doing this job is totally different.
Completely different. Let's just step back a little bit though and find out who Kerry Davis is. So you're a hill walker, Davis, not a climber.
I do climb a bit.
How did you get into hill walking? How did it all begin?
So just part of my upbringing, I think. So as it is for a lot of people, really, it was kind of it was something I did with my family, and so that just it just became kind of you know, part of my DNA, really. So we used to go several trips a year to the Yorkshire Dales and the lakes, and you know, just did a lot of walking as a kid, basically reluctantly at first, but but it kind of became, and I think it was always there. It was always something that was part of my upbringing. It was the best bit, you know, of my childhood, I think. And then, not that I had a really bad childhood, by the way. It was the bit I most enjoyed, you know, compared to school, for example, which is awful. And then I just kind of, maybe as a teenager and a student, I probably didn't do a lot. You know, I was more interested in other things at that kind of age. But then I kind of came back to, I guess, like as I, you know, started going out into the world on my own and started a job and, you know, started a career and all that sort of stuff. I just found that I was being drawn more back to the outdoors and to walking. And then I did a bit of, I trained as a news journalist, and then with the intention of going into newspapers, but obviously that was a terrible idea for the reasons I've just outlined. And then I did some traveling, and then ended up in New Zealand, and sort of, I was already kind of getting into hiking a lot by this point, and I did some big walks in New Zealand, you know, for me at the time, you know, big walks in New Zealand. And it just kind of cemented for me the idea that this was sort of what I wanted my life to be about. So I kind of thought, well, how can I marry this with like my professional kind of training? And then I came back and just was really looking. That was when I got the job with TGO, and then sort of that's kind of that's where things just kind of went from there, really.
You didn't set out to be an outdoor journalist. You set out to be a journalist.
Yeah, initially, right at the start, yeah.
So you must have had a passion for English, for the written word. Where did that come from?
Yeah, sure. I think just, again, probably upbringing, isn't it? A lot of these things come back to that. I think my parents are both very, you know, sort of literary. There was always books around when I was a kid and stuff. And I know when I was younger, I always wanted to be a writer. I remember specifically saying I want to be a writer, and then getting quite, when I was about seven or something, and then getting quite angry when my mum told me that there was work involved. And I was like, well, I'm annoyed about that. And then I used to do stuff like make little magazines and stuff, like I'd do, where I would like, I remember once I did one where like we'd been to a reservoir that was flooded, like Thrust Cross Reservoir, not far from here. And there's a flooded village underneath it, but the water level was so low one year that the buildings were exposed. And so I sort of like drew a picture of what the village would have looked like based on my extensive expertise, you know, of a knowledge of history and archaeology and such. And that's the kind of kid I was, do you know what I mean?
That's wonderful, is that? I mean, you talk about writing. I saw an Owen Shears talk once, who probably a name you recognise, and he said something that really resonated with me, that writing is rewriting.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
It's a constant process to
And it gets harder as well. That's the thing that they, you think it would get easier the better you get at it, but actually, like, real writing is a labor, you know. And I think it involves really having to sort of I have got better at it over the years, but I find it becomes harder to not find yourself repeating yourself. So that's because, so you kind of have to you have to constantly improve, and you also never really feel like you've, you know, it's both like anything really, it's probably like climbing or something as well, you know, you never really feel like you're there, like you've arrived, you know, you've always got, you can always improve. And I look back at stuff that I wrote, even, you know, in the past, and often I just think, oh, I'm so embarrassed that was published because it's just terrible, you know. And but it was, but then at the time I thought that was great, you know. So it's a constant process, and it's not, I don't think, you know, people sort of talk about writing as being, you know, fun, or like, you know, like it's, oh, I love writing, the magic of writing. And it's actually not all the time, it is a chore, you know, but it's something that you feel like you have to do because it's a, you know, it's like a compulsion that you need to do in order to make sense of the world and to sort of process your, and to understand yourself and to understand the world more, really.
You definitely have to craft it, don't you? Have to work at it.
Yeah, for sure. And it's that craft that's the key thing, really.
You must have quite a body of work now, though. Is that being collected for a book at some stage, or is that...
It could be, but I don't know why anyone would want to read that. So, I've had ideas that, I guess I've been regularly publishing, you know, things like Country Diaries, writing those for like the last 7 or 8 years. And there's obviously all the stuff that I've written for TGO actually over the years as well, and other bits and pieces. And I've also kind of had vague book ideas that I've kind of started work on, but often just found that I've been either gone off the idea or just been waylaid by like life, you know, and working life, because it's, and I think that's part of the dilemma that, you know, I kind of have. I think writing is the thing that I find most satisfying, but it's not necessarily the thing that pays the bills, or you know, so it's a bit of a catch-22. I'd love to do more writing professionally, but in order to get to that stage, I'd probably have to have a period of, you know, I don't know how you would earn money in order to earn money as a writer. You know, you kind of have to have a bit of a bit in between where you'd have to, So I mean, it's been the same for you, isn't it? You've done books and stuff before, but this, I wouldn't imagine that they're, you know, Elon Musk levels of wealth as a result of doing them.
They don't make money, that's for sure. I don't know where you have to be to get that breakthrough, you know, to make proper money.
Yeah.
Let me just ask you about Country Diary, Kerry, because that's a bit of a tangent for us. You know, we're hill walkers and we know you from TGO, but I do like those Country Diary pieces. How do they come about? Do you just have an idea, or do you have a sort of commission? Do you have to produce X number a year, or is it just, oh, I've got an idea, I'm going to write about it?
Yeah, it's totally the latter. It's really the brief. I've never really been given a brief for the Country Diary. So it's you're just kind of expected to know what constitutes a Country Diary. So it's a really long running column. It's been going for more than 100 years, quite significantly more, I think. Maybe 120 or something. But it over that time, it's kind of something that's evolved. And it's kind of the sum of all the people who write for it and the kind of history of it and so on. So you just have to intuit what you do in it, and obviously that takes, so it's one of the harder things to write actually, because the brief is like, it's easy to write to a really strict brief, you know. And I do that a lot, you know, like for TGO, for example, there's a lot of like writing that, you know, goes into the magazine that isn't, you know, you wouldn't know it's me, but it's me sort of thing. And that's the kind of thing you can just churn out very easily. But for something like the Country Diary, it's kind of, so it has to do so much in a very limited word count. So it kind of has to be an interesting, there has to be some so you have to evoke the surrounding landscape and the environment. You have to say, you have to tell a bit of a story, a bit of a narrative, albeit, you know, even a small one. You have to say something. I think you have to have some knowledge of like natural history. There has to be some natural history that goes into it, some understanding of some scientific kind of understanding, even if, again, like even if it's only small. And then it kind of has to be well written. It has to be, you know, it has to have a poetry to it and all the rest of it. And you have to do all that in 350 words. So, and that's a really difficult task as a writer. So even though it is only 350 words, which, you know, if I was writing 350 words on, you know, introducing the Teacher of Gear Awards or something like that now, I could do that pretty easily. But like for the Country Diary, is something that I sit, that kind of, you know, I'd really sit down and think about, and it kind of, it takes, you know, it takes a day or more to do it, just the writing. But the actual process of what I'd write about, again, it can sometimes, usually it's just purely kind of luck. It's like, I just wander around, I just do live my life, I wander around, and generally from month to month, something will catch my eye, or there'll be something that I'm thinking about, like something that happens in, I'll just be thinking, I'm thinking a lot about Rose Bay Willow Herb this month, you know, yeah. And then I've seen it a lot, it's, you know, and I'll write about that. And so it's really, and that generally tends to be the best way of doing it. I have done it before where I've thought there's a specific, because sometimes I thought, you know, these are just sometimes a bit too diffuse, so maybe I should research what I'm doing more. And so I've tried to do that on occasions, like I've done stuff where I've been like, oh, there's a really interesting story about, like, I did one about the lady slipper orchid, which is like this really, really rare orchid that was thought to be extinct in the 20s, and then they found it in the, somebody just stumbled across it at the site in the Dales in the 50s or 60s, and then it was literally physically guarded. It was the last one. It's physically, somebody slept next to it during, when it was in flower for months, for, I don't know, two decades or something like that. And then finally they installed motion sensor cameras there now and stuff. But like they took this one surviving orchid and then reproduced it, so now it's in lots of other sites in the north of England. But I just thought, oh, that's a cool story, like, and that's on my doorstep, so I'll go and write one about that. But I just found that in the end, I wasn't that happy with it, because it didn't have the element of spontaneity that comes from other things. Because I basically went there to the place where there are public places where you can see it, and I also maybe did a little bit of hunting around to try and find the original site, even though it's top secret, but because I was interested. And I just found that in the end, the result of it wasn't that amazing. I've done other stuff like that as well, like there was an interesting cave that was like the last place where brown bear bones have been found in the Dales. And I thought, you know, again, like, interesting, but just through the process of writing, I just ended up writing about, you know, it didn't really have a sense of presence, you know, it didn't really have a sense that I was there, and then like had no spontaneity really. So that I generally try and keep it, it's a bit, you're flying by the seat of your pants a bit more, but generally I try and keep it spontaneous.
It's like when somebody goes on a journey and writes a book about the journey, or somebody goes on a journey to write a book about the journey. And it's quite a different feel, isn't it? So you are doing a good job there, Kerry, because, you know, you're following in some pretty big shoes, and I suspect you've got quite a critical audience that you need to be mindful of. So well done. That's I would say that's quite a challenge, that. So good effort.
It is, yeah. I mean, yeah, thanks. But I suppose, like, most of the thing that I find with it is sometimes it actually doesn't seem to, like, I don't know, like, compared to other kind of content, online content, it doesn't seem to get massive numbers of comments or kind of engagements and stuff. So it's sort of, and most of the commenters, there's usually half a dozen, and they usually seem pretty enthusiastic. But yeah, you're right in the sense that, like, you know, there will be, you know, most people reading something like that. And it's the same with TGO to a degree, that most people reading it will be people who are, you know, naturalists, or have some, you know, that a lot of the time they won't necessarily just be like general readers who stumble across it. There'll be people who kind of follow it and are, you know, in some way interested in the world of naturalism. And they'll, you know, they will spot mistakes. Like, I, you know, okay, in one of my early ones, like I think I mentioned that I saw a yellow wagtail, and then it was actually, yeah, obviously it was a grey wagtail, and somebody wrote that in, but of course grey wagtails are yellow, so it was a yellow wagtail, it just wasn't a yellow wagtail. Yeah, exactly. So you do get that kind of thing, but I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of it's the same with TGL to some degree, but
I'm going to come back to TGL. I've got quite a few questions about TGL, but you did have this break from journalism, didn't you, with the BMC? How did that come about? What were you doing there, and did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it was a break. It was a break to some extent. It did involve elements of, not journalism per se, but it did involve like communications and campaigns and a lot of, you know, again, like a lot of the.
You were the hill walking, right? That was your job.
Yeah, I was the hill walking development officer. Yeah, for the BMC. It was one of these things where it was an extremely broad brief, and so that's probably putting it mildly. So I kind of got into it was this new job, and I got in and just kind of tried to make it my own, really, and tried to develop it. But that was probably one of the most challenging aspects of it because obviously you say hill walking officer, and it kind of makes, I guess we know what that means, don't we? But what does that really mean? What does that actually consist of? Because hill walking is obviously has lots of different components to it. So obviously, yeah, like in the way that climbing does. And so the BMC don't have a climbing officer, do they? They've got, you know, they've got things, they've got people who deal with guidebooks, people who deal with access and conservation, people who deal with walls, people who deal with the technical side of things. You know, they have all these, they don't just have a climbing officer. So you have that level of complexity in hill walking as well. So that was kind of like that was the most difficult aspect of it. So basically I tried to play to my strengths, and I focused on doing stuff around I increasingly kind of went more towards the access and conservation side of things, and I tried to write a lot of stuff for the BMC media, for its magazine and for the website, and I developed campaigns that like Mendel Mountains, and so I tried to do that. But other people would have taken a different approach with it, you know. Other people would have gone, like, you know, if I was a mountain leader or something like that, I would have probably focused more on the training and education side of things. And you could easily have hired somebody to do that side of things purely for hill walking as well. But I did. I mean, the BMC is a good, I mean, as you know, like, it's a good organization to work for as an employee, lots of good people there and good conditions of the job. But I think the frustrating aspect of it was the sort of, and this was stuff I said, you know, and it's not like I'm making any, spilling the beans or anything, but I found it that the lack of strategy and vision was sometimes a little bit frustrating. It's like they couldn't really work out whether they wanted to go in this direction or that direction. And that wasn't just about hill walking, as you know, like that was a kind of, you know, across the whole spectrum, really. And so I was just kind of, as a lot of people, a lot of staff and a lot of people within the organization, I was just sort of sat in there kind of waiting to see which way the boat was going to eventually turn. Yeah. And it never quite did. So I just kind of tried to make the best of it while I was there. And I enjoyed working there. And,
Yeah, I guess it's turning now, the BMC ship, and I'll talk to somebody who knows more about that in due course, because it's, you know, like you, I'm very enthusiastic about the BMC, and I want it to do well, but it's got to find its way a little bit again, hasn't it? So you came back to TGO, and TGO, it's just, the thing I find really difficult, Carey, is I don't buy magazines very often, or newspapers, because I get the news on my phone. I get the information on my phone, and it's free as well. So how do you sort of square that circle? Because we all just Google it, don't we?
Yeah. I think it's kind of what we were talking about earlier about having presences in lots of different areas of media. So you have your increasingly what's happening with magazine brands. And I say that specifically because we're not just a magazine, we're a magazine brand, we're a title. is that you're moving away from being a purely a print product, and you're going towards being like a brand that produces content that goes across lots of different platforms. And yeah. So that's the key thing for us, really, and that's the we're on the way towards being that, but there's still some way to go. We have so it's basically, it's horses for courses, really. So we have, you find that, I mean, we're constantly kind of trying to develop the online side of things, but we find that, you know, so social media is obviously really important for kind of getting your content out there, but also just having the kind of content that people stumble across through search engines, you need to have that as well. So we have things like our gear reviews and so on that are really, they're optimized for SEO score and so on, so that they're found by search engines. And that's some of the most popular content we've got on the website. It's just like Chris Townsend's waterproof jackets review. So people are engaging with our brand in that way, but it's like there's as you know, like the internet obviously has the whole world on it. So you could be getting like anybody coming across that review, you know. Whereas the print product is still there, it's still really key. But it's probably good, we're probably moving towards a point where, you know, we are still there on newsstands, so you can pick up the magazine casually. And there is still a massive place for that. People still do that. Like, but it's not necessarily the main way that people get general information anymore. But what you also find is a magazine, is a print product is a much more kind of immersive experience. You can sit down with it. You can, so it's almost like the print thing, it gives you that tactile experience, and it kind of, you know, it's like having a vinyl or something like that. It kind of, it has that realness to it. And also, I think to a large extent, people subscribe to magazines and publications because it's kind of part of their identity as well. So, you know, like I get a few publications, I get a few, you know, that I read a bit of them, but mainly I get them because I like what they say about me. You know, I like the idea of like subscribing to a, you know, a highbrow journal or something like that, because it makes me feel very highbrow. Even though I only read like 2% of it. So, and I think it's the same, like, you know, if it's part of, you kind of feel like you're part of a group, part of a kind of a bit of a tribe. And I think that's the role increasingly of like the print side of things as well, is that we're probably moving towards a position where you get you emphasize that aspect of like, this print magazine is for, you know, the real aficionados and the sort of the connoisseurs of the activity. And then, you know, that the online presence is much broader, and that's where we're probably going to get the new audiences from, you know, and we already are to some degree. So it's kind of having just an understanding about the different types of media that you've got at your disposal, and working as best you can within them all. And it's the same, like, you know, with the way to go in that, that's a massive thing, you know.
So you can put different things in the magazine, different types of articles that perhaps go into more depth or more background.
I suppose the magazine tends to have the long form content in it, so, you know, full longer features, big imagery, and that type of thing, and I think that kind of content always works a lot better in print. So that's for me that's the main appeal of the print product, and we don't tend to put that kind of content on our website. The stuff that we do online generally tends to be the stuff that has more obvious, you know, utility, like gear reviews. You know, I just want this piece. Just want to know what the best hiking shoe is. So yeah, that'll go online, you know. And so that content also will appear in print, but there's a lot of crossovers. Like a lot of our online content finds its way into the print magazine. A lot of the print magazine finds its way online. But, you know, I think there's probably something that we are in the process of thinking about, kind of what we do in the future with the different types of content that we've got, and optimizing them for the different platforms that we have. So the print magazine at the moment is a bit of a mix of like long form content, gear reviews, walking routes. It's still like got a bit of everything in it. Yeah. But maybe in the future we might think about a situation where we've got, you know, walking routes. Because, I mean, I don't think that many people look at the print products anymore for walking routes, for example. Maybe I'm wrong. And we do surveys and stuff to try and find out that kind of information. But, you know, maybe we would actually be doing better being more selective about what walking routes we put in the print magazine, and then maybe putting the bulk of our content in that regard online. And saving the magazine for the kind of longer form, you know, coffee table kind of content. You know, that's one way you can do it.
More journal style, really. But
yeah,
not like Country Diary, but in the same way, the Great Outdoors has been around for a long time, hasn't it? So you've got quite a legacy there, and you've got a USP with that magazine.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know who's listening, but you know, would it be the more highbrow, the more in-depth, the more educated walking magazine? Would that be?
I like to think so.
You like to think so. Some of the others, it's a bit subtle.
Yeah. It's probably more, it's always been a magazine that's had a degree of like intelligence to it. So, and probably more than it needs to have for where it sits in the marketplace, if you know what I mean. So we have sometimes some quite challenging and some content and often some very thoughtful content that goes into the magazine. We always have done, and that'll be sitting next to, you know, on newsstands, next to much more sort of, you know, easily sort of digestible sort of stuff. But that's always been an element of it, and I think that's something I've definitely wanted to retain. But it's the same, all the key attributes of the magazine and the brand, like intelligence is one of them. It's always been known for being authentic, you know, like the people who write for it and produce it sort of are the real deal. They do the activity extensively and they know what they're talking about. And it's always had to some degree a kind of a bit of an environmental consciousness. But I think those qualities are in need of, we can't approach those things in the same way, exactly the same way that we did 10 or 20 years ago, you know, because there's a generational turnover going on in the outdoors. There's a new generation of people who are defining kind of what the outdoor culture is. And so we have to take, I'm basically, my approach is take all those things that were good and reframe them, rearticulate them in a way that a younger demographic can understand and feel that they can relate to. So it's not about losing kind of what we've had in the past. It's about keeping it, but you do need to sort of change it in a way that makes sense, and add in, maybe also lose a few of the elements that weren't positive, or that maybe weren't seen as, you know, that were more problematic in that respect, and then add some new ones in as well. So, and that process has actually been going on with TGO for, you know, before, like the previous editor, Emily, did a lot of work in that respect. And so I worked quite closely with her when I was deputy editor as well. So like I feel like I'm just kind of carrying that on, really. But I think I've been doing the job for 2.5 years. A big part, like obviously developing the editorial side of things has been really important, but I'd say probably one of the biggest things that's taken up a lot of my attention is actually the commercial side of things as well, which isn't something that a reader necessarily will see or, you know, like advertising is one of those things that kind of has to be done. You have to have a healthy bottom line for TGO to exist. But it's obviously, that's one of the biggest challenges in this day and age where you've got social media giants who can offer targeted advertising to, you know, millions of people at a click. How do you make a relevant proposition to advertising clients in this day and age? And there is one, but it involves working with them, working with brands differently. And it's really, there's a lot more input from the editorial side of things as well. So that's probably, it's not something that like is necessarily obvious that's been going on to readers, but it has taken up like a lot of my time. But luckily now TGO is on a really, it's on a positive commercial footing. And that gives me a platform to, you know, take things to the next level in terms of, you know, developing the brand and renew, you know, kind of maybe refreshing our identity a bit more, you know.
Yeah. Are there conflicts in there then, Kerry? Because I know you could probably churn out a magazine of people like gear things, don't they? They like skills. But, you know, I know like me, you want to challenge those big environmental issues of the day, and you want hill walkers to be informed about those issues of the day. But then, of course, you've got to keep the advertisers, keep the commercial side happy as well, haven't you? So
yeah.
Do you find you're balancing a lot of conflicts there?
No, I think it's part of the skill of being an editor, really, is to like work out. You can tackle, and we do. I mean, we do still tackle. You know, we've had stuff. I mean, in the last year, we've covered things like some pretty weighty stuff, and we still do cover it. But you also have to have in the magazine the stuff that's going to, you know, get. You have to have a strategy of how you work with advertisers. So as long as you're kind of doing that, as long as you've got that you're doing the content there that kind of keeps that aspect of things covered, and then that gives you the leeway to kind of do the other stuff, which is maybe more interesting from a really like sales point of view, maybe even from mine, but like, you know, obviously it's a lot of, yeah, I do a lot of different stuff, but yeah, so to some degree, but I think I just try and get as cohesive a whole as I can. And yes, it is a challenge. But you know, as long as we've got, I always try and, you know, I have a structure for each magazine, for each edition, and a sense of what I want to get out of it in each one. And so you do that, you try and build a cohesive whole out of all these different parts, really. So there are ways that you can do that. I always try and make sure there's some type of theme that runs through the content in any given issue that ties things together. But I think also some brands, you know, like campaigns and stuff can be used as a way of, and it's not necessarily the case that brands are just totally put off by having coverage of serious issues in it. Well, I think primarily what they're interested in is like, are you prepared to work with them to in a much more integrated way than you would have done in the past? And if you're doing that, then generally that, you know, that's what they want, that's the key thing. And I don't think brands are they're not there poring over everything else in the magazine, you know. They kind of, they just want to know, are you prepared to work with me to collaborate to promote this particular product of line or whatever. So that's if you do that, then they're generally okay, you know.
Yeah. Pulling it together, it just sounds really challenging, Kerry. I remember the days where you'd have an idea and you'd just write a piece and you'd send it speculatively to the magazines, and they might print it or not print it. Presumably, you've got to be looking a year ahead and commissioning pieces and working with regular journalists to produce the magazine. You've got to have a big year planner of deadlines, surely.
You do. And I'm probably like not necessary. Well, I have, for things like gear reviews, obviously you've got to get that in advance. Content, I do as much as I can in that respect. But you are, I am still very reliant on the incidental content that people produce, if you know what I mean. Well, not incidental, but like there is still a massive part of the magazine, which is like people, freelancers and, you know, contributors, saying, I've done this trip, are you interested? I've done this trip, I've got these pictures, are you interested in doing a feature on it? That's still like a really important part of it. But yes, we do, and I think we probably want to do more in the way of like thinking ahead and directing content, but that becomes more expensive to do. So still TJO wouldn't exist if it wasn't for contributors, you know, doing things and then taking that content and kind of giving it, you know, offering it to me. And then what I do from then is I basically just have like, so putting together a puzzle, really. You've got you'll have all these loose ideas, and then I try and fit them into a particular theme for that issue. And I then, you know, usually quite often themes emerge from all that, and then you kind of bring them together into something as cohesive as you can make it. But that's the way that we work anyway. Other magazines work slightly differently, and they have more in-house people who produce the content more regularly, and that probably does give them a bit more control and ability to plan ahead. But I think we'd want to do a bit. I wouldn't want to equally, and that has its advantages, but I wouldn't want to lose the kind of variety and the different styles and different personal perspectives that you get from having, and the, you know, the range that you get from that more kind of freelance heavy model, really.
So that's really encouraging, because a lot of the audience that we'll have today will be mountain leaders or mountaineering instructors. So what are you saying is pull your finger out, folk, and come up with some ideas for some pieces for us?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm always open to ideas. I'm not always amazing at responding to them. I would say basically my advice to anybody is kind of the same, really, is that you look at them. I'm just in the middle of doing a thing.
What is it?
It's an interview, but it's a live interview, but don't worry.
How long are you going to be?
A while. Sorry, I'm just having a conversation here.
This makes it real, folks. Anybody listening?
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, I'm having one. You know, like in the news interviews where the child walks in.
That's right. If anybody else, it's scary if they can just pop them in that the comments there. So I've enabled comments, so just pop them in there. Then they should pop up on my screen. I've got a couple in there at the moment, but yeah, if you have any questions, just pop them in there, because we're not going to go off much longer. Actually, we are coming towards the end. So as we get towards the end, just a couple more TGO things. Tell me about the TGO challenge, because that's kind of something that's been around for years. I've always felt it's gone under the radar a bit. There's so many events out there. There's too many events now, aren't there? But that TGO challenge has just tinkled away out of sight of most people, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think it's it has been going for a while and it's still going. We still support it a lot. But yeah, I think, I mean, it's not something I have a great deal to do with myself. It's kind of almost exists as it does have its own sort of identity. There are organizers that kind of deal with it. So I don't have a lot to do with the kind of day-to-day organization of it, but we support it through promotion and so on, and it's obviously got our, you know, it's the TGO challenge and so on, so it's still very much like our identity is kind of linked to it, and it's a great event. Like, it's it has a real community around it, which is you know, quite a valuable thing, I think, in this day and age, but it's I personally like to see more people know about it, and we do our best in that respect to kind of, you know, get it out to the world. And I think the organizers would agree, you know, they'd sort of like to get it out into the world a bit more, but yeah, I think it's one of these things that's a bit of a challenge for the future, I guess, is thinking about how you take these long established things and kind of make them relevant to newer people, you know.
That's a nice thing. And because the other time TGO pops into everybody's inbox is when you do your awards, isn't it, your annual awards.
Yeah,
really successful. So tell us a bit about the awards, but also there's a kind of a problem of having, you know, there is the best cafe in Snowdonia, and it's hard to beat the best cafe in Snowdonia every year. Is there any secret to producing new winners?
Yeah, it's a good question. We do tend to have like some perennial favourites that kind of pop up. So some categories just tend to be kind of dominated by, like, people just have their favourites, don't they? I don't know. Like, is Pete's Eats really that good? Like, honestly. I mean, that's heresy to sort of suggest that, isn't it? But like, people just love it, don't they? But
they
kind of win. I'm joking, but like, they kind of win like a lot of the same. They win things every year, don't they? And like, but we've brought in a couple of new categories, which I think has kind of renewed things a little bit. So we've got a category for like the open outdoors, which is like people who have done things to kind of get people from non-traditional backgrounds into the outdoors, and we brought in another one for what's the other one? I should know this, really.
Earlier, but I've forgotten.
Just sustainability, I think.
No, it's good. They're good, the awards. They're nice, nice things.
Yeah. So, but basically, like, it's a really, yeah, it's kind of, we do get, there are a couple of awards, like the pubs and the cafes and stuff, that tend to have the same, a lot of the same, you know, nominees and winners in them. But a lot of the other ones kind of, people do come and go, and it is reflective of the way that things kind of change. So, like, the Campaigner of the Year category often has new, you know, new people in it from year to year. The other category that's brought in is filmmaker, best film or filmmaker. That was it. Sorry, I was thinking of the Gear Awards, and that's and again, that's reflective of, like, you know, changing media and so on. So we kind of, it does tend to move with the times as well, and you do see kind of different things from year to year. So that's it's always really interesting to see what's going to come up.
Kerry, I want to move towards a close, but before we go there, I just want to come back to you yourself. And do you still go hill walking? Do you have time?
Fair bit. I mean, as much as I think, what I think, guess, like, from a, I can't go hill walking as much as anybody with a job, you know, and but I think what probably sometimes people might look at me and go, I bet that guy spends all the time just kind of, like, frivolously walking around in the mountains kind of on my own. Or just, like, you know, for, as part of the job, if you see what I mean. And it isn't really like that. There's kind of, yes, I probably do get to go out more than most people, but the job is still kind of a job that's primarily kind of, you know, desk based, if you know what I mean. But the subject matter is obviously, like, a lot, you know, very interesting to me. But yeah, I mean, I get out kind of walking. It's probably, you know, I get up to Scotland at least a couple of times a year. I go to the lakes and the dales a lot, because they're kind of on my doorstep, and, like, sort of just do kind of a lot of running and bit and things that are kind of broadly outdoor adjacent, I guess, like indoor climbing and bouldering and stuff. So I keep active, but I would, you know, I kind of would like to be more, it would be great to do more outdoorsy stuff as part of the job, but tend to find that the job is, you know, it is so demanding that you tend to just do the job, if you know what I mean. I get other people to do stuff, and that can be, so they, like, that you, in a way, you're kind of better off being a TGO contributor in a way, because then you get the commissions to go out and do stuff, and then you get paid for that. You know what I mean?
All the places you want to go to.
What's that, sorry?
You send people off to all the places you want to go to.
Yeah, basically. Although sometimes I don't, because it depends what the weather's like. So if
are you a peak bagger? Are you collecting summits?
Not really, no. Like, I've sort of never really been into that side of things, because I don't know, like, it kind of, maybe over a lifetime I might just keep a tally of what I've done with the Munros and stuff, but the idea of, like, going, I suppose what draws me to places is often just, like, the interest of that particular landscape. That means that, like, the idea of just going to bagging peaks isn't necessarily always what I want to do, but also, you know, that, I guess there are bits of Scotland that, like, I'm not actually that interested in. And although everybody says, you know, if you do the Munros, you get to go to the bits of Scotland that you don't think you're interested in, but turn out to be really nice. So maybe I'm wrong, but I mean, I've probably done most of the Wainwrights without really meaning to. But again, like, I've never really kept a tally. Maybe one day, but it's kind of, I respect people who, you know, I'm not anti hill bagging or anything like that.
I love it. I love that. And a final question then, should we be calling it hiking now?
I use the word hiking quite a lot. Yeah. I mean, I think these people sometimes get to a stage where these things sort of become a bit, like, sealed into a certain orthodoxy, isn't there? There's kind of certain language that you can use and can't use and all the rest of it. But I think what you find is that, like, increasingly like younger, if you look at kind of younger people that are into the outdoors, you spend any time, don't spend too much time, but if you go on Instagram or anything like that and you look at people kind of, you know, the language that people use, it's a lot more like, you know, broad, and people aren't as fussed about these using words like hiking or whatever, you know, like they're sort of, yeah, people are a lot more like relaxed in their use of language, really. So that's what I kind of mean about the generational turnover to some extent, is that like the it was always a word that, I mean, like when I used to work on TGO back in the day, hike was always a word that we avoided because it was supposed to be Americanism and all the rest of it, but that, I think that's kind of, that's kind of thing, it's just, it's not anymore.
When I started, it was hiking in the probably the 70s. It was,
well, exactly, hike is a word that was used in Britain like a quite a long time ago, you know. So that's I think the, yeah, the, so it's really, these things just come and go, don't they, you know, sort of swings around.
We're gonna have to finish there, but I've just got one question come in. Do you have any, this is Al Thompson says, do you have any great worries or fears for the outdoor industry in general? If you could be really brief, Kerry, that'd be awesome.
Yeah,
it's massive, isn't it? No, they're making money.
What's that?
They're making money.
Yeah, I mean, generally, the outdoor industry is pretty buoyant at the moment. That's the impression I get, because post-pandemic, there was like a, it's a paradox, isn't it, that like after, you know, a year and a half where everybody's been stuck inside, actually that's led to it makes sense, it's not really a paradox, but like I guess because that was the effect of lockdowns has actually been to interest people, a lot more people in the outdoors, so the outdoor industry has actually had, I think there was obviously a big dip with, you know, in that kind of March to May first lockdown, but then after that I think things picked up massively when people realized they weren't going to go away abroad and so on. So the outdoor industry right now seems to be having a pretty good time, and we noticed, you know, our readership went, I mean I like to think it was because of the, you know, massive sort of the massive improvement that my editorial vision brought to it, but we had an increase of like about a third after the you know, in that period following the kind of first lockdown and so on. So our circulation is kind of pretty healthy as well, and I'm sure the pandemic will have played a big part in that. So right now the outdoor industry seems to be okay, you know, and yeah, there's lots of debates about what the outdoor industry should be doing, and particularly, you know, when COP26 is going on, the lots of interesting debates around like what the, you know, how companies and businesses and so on should respond to that, this challenge, how we have, you know, I wonder these things as well, and lots of, you know, arguments about representation and inclusivity and so on, but I think the outdoor industry seems to be pretty, you know, in terms of is it all right, will it continue to, it seems to be relatively, it seems to be flourishing at the moment, so that's positive from that point of view.
Well, that's great, Kerry. We're talking to Richard Talbot later on in this series from Mountain Equipment, and he's really keen to come on and talk about the environmental impact of the outdoor gear and that sort of sector, so I'm looking forward to that. But hey, listen, Kerry, thank you very much indeed.
No worries.
For coming along and talking to us today. I'm going to finish it there, and I look forward to seeing you again sometime.
Yes, indeed. We'll be publishing your column soon as well, won't we?
Oh, great. Yes. Bye, bye, TJ, everybody. I might be in it.
Yeah.
Jochen, see you now.
See you.